So, Professor Gunfreud, thank you very much for agreeing to sit down with us. As we discussed, we will be talking. The goal of this interview is to talk mostly about the period 1975 to 1995. But to get to understand this period, I'd like to go back a little in your career, and if you could maybe help to situate us, right, help us understand. What drew you to physics, and how did you get to choose to do a PhD in physics in the first place?
Now, what drew me into physics, I was a student at the Hebrew University. This is the Raqqa Institute of Physics, the legendary Giulio Raqqa, who was forced to leave Mussolini's Italy because he was a Jew. He settled in Jerusalem in 1940. He established theoretical physics in Israel. He was a pioneer in applying group theoretical methods, quantum physics to atomic spectroscopy. I was fortunate in the 60s when I enrolled as a student at the university to have all my theoretical courses from him. It was natural to continue. I did my PhD on nuclear reactions at the Hebrew University. And then I went to Stanford as a postdoctoral student of Felix Bloch. And that brought me into the field of superconductivity. And Felix Bloch, after a year, went on a sabbatical. And I then began to work with William Bill Little. I don't know if you know the name. He is best known for his ideas or his quest on high temperatures, superconductivity, long before it was discovered, specifically organic superconductivity. I did a lot of work with him in 1973, 1974. I came back to Stanford for 1 year, a sabbatical year. At that time, Little was interested in neural networks. See, neural networks.
So before we dive into this, do you mind just stepping back 1 second? So yes. Going back to because you, as you said, your PhD was in nuclear physics, and then you went in a clearly solid state physics group. What was your motivation?
To do solid state physics.
So what drew you to this?
The main motivation was that Felix Bloch agreed to take me as a postdoctoral student. That was enough. Felix Bloch, anything he would have done, I would follow.
Okay, so you knew of his work and you
close to him and inspired by him.
Okay. So, okay. So getting back to your sabbatical at Stanford.
I came back to Jerusalem, 1968, 69, a young lecturer. And then I came back to Stanford for a sabbatical year to continue my work with Bill Little. We did a lot of work together on the prospect of organic superconductivity, organic conductivity. And at that time, Bill Little had an idea of a kind of a neural network model. Now, neural networks as a field began formally, we marked the genesis of neural networks with the work of McCulloch and Pitts in 1943. Where they introduced this model of binary neurons connected by so-called synaptic junctions. This was a kind of a caricature neuron, but they could show that a network with a kind of connected of such binary elements connected by a kind of efficacies, could perform any calculation that a Turing machine could perform. So this was a kind of a first implementation of this idea, prophecy of Turing, of thinking machines. There were several developments in this direction. There was the idea of a perceptron implying this to a kind of layered networks where you can develop such calculating devices that would give you a desired connection between input and output. Now, the second major development in this area was the work of the psychologist Donald Hebb in 1949, who conjectures that every cognitive event that happens in our brain is connected to some persistent activity of a certain class, a certain group of neurons. And he also conjectured, and that is the basis until today, that learning is proceeds by changes in these connections between neurons, by the changes in synaptic efficacies. So these were the first, the two basic elements. Then followed the whole Minsky-Papert venture of perceptrons, which are such networks, such layered networks, where you where a calculation proceeds from an input layer to an output layer. So it's not an easy, not a very successful attempt, by the way. And then there were the first steps to try to imitate these binary neurons with binary physical systems. And the classical, of course, the classical candidate for them, for that was magnetic dipoles. There was an attempt already in 1954 to do something like that. Crabb and Temperley are the names associated with this development. But in 1974, Bill Little had an idea which really struck me and had an impact for years to come. He was talking, I mean, he suggested that these persistent activities of a group of neurons that would represent a cognitive event, a memory, an idea, a command to your muscles that occurs in the brain, that that could be associated or could be mimicked, modeled by a persistent state of a spin system. Now, his idea was the following. His model was a two-dimensional icing spins model, where you have layer after layer that layers all the spins or all the neurons in one layer represent the activity of those neurons at time t. The second layer represents the activity of the same group of neurons at time t plus one, and so on from layer to layer. Between the layers, you have all the JIJ connections from one layer to another, and so forth. And the idea was to see under what circumstances, as you proceed in that, a persistent activity would develop. You would have the same configuration from one state to another. Now, the basic element that he introduced was the transition matrix. The transition matrix is the matrix that tells you what is the probability that having a configuration J in one layer which take you to a configuration I in another layer. This, of course, is a vast matrix. And then he introduced the notion for the first time, he introduced the notion of temperature into the neural activity. Temperature, I mean, is an important element in a physical system. The temperature in the neural network was the uncertainty, was related to the uncertainty of a neuron firing once it received the input from all the other neurons connected to that. So he was the first who introduced the notion of temperature into the networks. And I'll tell you in a minute what was missing. Then he showed that if this transition matrix would have degenerate eigenvalues, value one, separated from all the other eigenvalues, then a persistent state would develop, and he tried to push it a long way. When I came back to Jerusalem.
So before we do this, because you knew him well, do you know what got him interested in neural networks? From superconductivity, it seems like a big jump, but maybe it's obvious.
It's hard to tell, but I can tell you one thing about having known him well. He's still alive, by the way, at Stanford, advanced age, not very well, but alive. He was a very imaginative individual. Whenever we met, whenever we talked, he had some idea that I couldn't tell where it came from. He had a kind of a neural network proof of one of Fermat's theorems, for example. Just something very surprising, unexpected. He was imaginative. I don't know what really triggered him. So he tried to promote it, to push it. I came back to Jerusalem. I was fascinated by this. I had a colleague in Jerusalem. His name was Daniel Amit. Daniel Amit died in 2007. Together, we explored this idea. Little came to Jerusalem in 1980, but we could not, there was no way for that we saw how to connect these persistent states or the configuration of in a persistent state with the eigenvectors and eigenvalues of that transition matrix. And then in 1982, something happened, which for us was an eye-opener. It was a revelation. And that was John Hopfield's model in 1982. You see, Bill Little went half of the way. He introduced temperature into models of neural networks. It was not there before, not the perceptrons, not McCulloch and Pitts, nobody before that. Hopfield introduced energy. Energy was the parameter that drove the dynamics of such a network. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Hopfield's paradigm, summarize it briefly, the main ideas, and then continue with my personal and institutional history. And has to do, it's closely related to my institution. It's closely related to what happened in those years at École Normale Supérieure, and we very closely collaborated with everybody there, in a few and a few other places. You see, until Hopfield, one discussed neural networks as connections of neurons in a layered architecture. The calculation of such a network was very simple. It proceeded from one layer, next layer, until the final layer where you read out the result. Hopfield assumed a network with a lot of feedback. Now, the extreme case would be that every neuron is connected to every other neuron, and then the whole system evolves under a certain dynamical rule. Now, he assumed that the connections between the neurons, what in neural networks are the synaptic efficacies, were symmetrical, are symmetrical. Now, this was the great advantage. It was an advantage because it allowed to do physics, to develop models, to solve models. It was a great step backwards because it took us further away from the real system. Real neural networks in a living organism, I mean, the connections between are certainly not symmetrical. More than that, if neuron I affects neuron J by a synaptic connection, there is no reason, and usually it's not the case, that neuron J affects also neuron I. So real networks are clearly asymmetrical. Now this was a cause for debates, but also a lot of criticism from our biological colleagues. They even ridiculed us for taking up steps, roads, which are so clearly remote from any real system. Still, this symmetry, which one could relax afterwards, and I tell you how that happened, this symmetry played an essential role in the early days of that followed the Hopfield model. Now, Hopfield already in his seminal paper, the last sentence there says that these systems are similar to spin glass systems. No, not more than that. But with Daniel Amit and myself, we immediately knew how and what direction to proceed. At that time, a bright Israeli student came back to Israel after his postdoctoral work with Bernd Halperin in Harvard. His name is Chaim Sompolinsky. Chaim Sompolinsky, until today, is a star, and I would say a superstar of this field. And so he came back and he joined another university in Israel, the Bar Ilan University. He knew a lot about spin glasses at that time, more than anyone of us. So we invited him to Jerusalem. We started to discuss these things. He was immediately taken by it. And the three of us, over the next few years, had, until today, I would say, the greatest time, at least, of my life. This was a time there was a real sense of being pioneers in something. There was a real sense of great challenges, and one result followed after another. And of course, the idea was the following, that here you have a network of such binary elements that are connected by these synaptic efficacies. And these connections are random. And since initially every element is connected to all other elements, we had a system with long-range interactions. So in a way, there was already a model which was a landmark in the spin glass activity, which was very, very intensive in those days. And that was the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. This is the spin glass with random connections with long range. The long range guaranteed that one could use mean field theory to treat subsystems. And of course, this randomness of connections implied that in order to do averaging over this disorder, you have to use what is called the replica trick, which at that time was already developed, discussed, was a main topic in the study of disordered systems with people like Giorgio Parisi in Rome, with others. So the elements were already there. Now, the main idea of this model applied to neural networks was that such a network is exposed to an external stimulus, which would impose a certain initial configuration. That configuration would evolve. And the question is, under the dynamics, whether that configuration would then, after a certain amount of steps, would converge or would end up in a certain persistent configuration. Those persistent configurations were called attractors, and this whole scheme was called calculating by attractors. And of course, the idea was, and the goal was, to develop a system where you could embed in a system a large amount of such persistent states, namely configurations, where in the end of a certain dynamical process, the system would converge there and then oscillate in the very close neighborhood of that state. Now the question was how many such states you could embed in a system, what would be their basins of attraction. So this was the essence of the model. And we were able, with Daniel Amit, Chaim Samponinsky, and myself, to find an analytical solution of the Hopfield model, where we assumed that certain configurations, which we chose in advance, certain configurations would then serve as the attractors or the kind of would represent these cognitive events of the neural network and initially those configurations were chosen at random, but without any correlations between them. They were unbiased, namely the same number of plus and minus directions of the representative spin in that configuration. And then the idea was to find the symmetric efficacies that connect the two elements, the neurons, namely the JIJ parameters, that would then, the dynamics when the system was exposed to any external stimulus, namely to an initial configuration, would flow to one of those attractors, to one of those configurations. That was the challenge. And that was our, I think, a great triumph by being able to solve it, but we called it a great triumph of statistical physics, because that was the first time that statistical physics was introduced into a system that initially was designed to imitate or to model a brain or a neural network's activity.
Yes.
So a short break. You may ask a question because I have a lot to say. I have a lot more to say.
Sure. So for one thing, were you at any point of this process engaged in a conversation with Hopfield, or you were really doing this on your own?
Hopfield knew all about that. I should tell you in a minute about the international connections, collaborations, the major meetings, the other players. Well, a lot of that happened. You see, we published our work in 1985. In 1986, the Institute for Advanced Studies in Santa Barbara, Robert Schiffer, one of the BCS trio in superconductivity. Robert Schiffer was the director, and he then organized a special program on neural networks. John Hopfield was the head of that program. We all participated there. You see, these were the interactions were very intensive in those days. There were major players. Our group, there was a very strong, diverse group in Ecole Normale Supérieure with people like Gérard Toulouse, Marc Mézard, younger colleague, and a few others. There was Parisi, Miguel Virasoro, Pelletti in Rome. And there were these other schools that still continued to do the layered neural networks. These were the first days at the same time of AI. I remember the great excitement in the United States was an effort to apply these layered neural networks to the recognition, to the mechanical recognition of zip codes. And there is a whole drama associated with that. We were not involved in that. When we came back from Santa Barbara, we at the Hebrew University also have a school for advanced studies, which organizes groups every year. And in 1987, we organized here a session, a whole year, around these developments, physics, neural networks, computation, and biology. And we have representatives of all four disciplines. So we also organized a group like that. Gerard Toulouse was here, and I will tell you something else about what happened at that year in 87 in Jerusalem, because it's another landmark in the evolution of this field. But let me come back to this a little later. Let me just now tell you about the Hopfield model. You see, the Hopfield model had several advantages. One is that it could be analytically solved. And once you have a model that can be solved, it gives you a certain confidence in what you are doing. But then that model was amenable to numerous modifications, relaxing all kinds of initial restrictions. It could be shown that it is the results that we found we could calculate the storage capacity of such a model. Then we could relax many of the initial apparent limitations. For example, we could show that our results are very robust with respect to all kinds of changes. That introducing asymmetry in the connecting junctions just acts as an additional noise, similar to temperature, another source of noise. You see, these models act under can be effective under finite temperature. In fact, we could show that temperature noise, including noise introduced by asymmetry, has certain beneficial effects, because the original Hopfield model, in addition to those basins of attraction which represent those final states that presumably model certain cognitive events, around, in addition to those, there are many, many spurious states which have nothing to do with those attractors that supposedly are meaningful in a sense. Noise, in a certain sense, including asymmetry, erases those attractors, makes the energy surface more smooth, leaving the deep, meaningful attractors, reducing the others, particularly the exponentially many spin glass minima, which are there, which are still there in that spin system. So a lot could be done. I still did not mention replica symmetry or the replica method. Clearly, when you deal with such disordered systems, with quenched disorder, and you want to calculate the free energy, you have to average over that disorder. And instead, you know, it's not simple to average over the logarithm of this function, of the z function, and therefore you apply this replica symmetry trick, which is mathematically very elegant, mathematically raises deep questions. Some of them are still unresolved, but the method works, clearly very amply supported in cases where you can reach the results by other methods, very amply supported by numerical calculations. And we, for us, of course, Chaim Sompolinski knew that all the time when he came, when he joined us, but for us, it was also a learning period, a very rewarding learning period, coping with all these mathematical tools. Chaim Sompolinski, as I told you, came back to Bar-Ilan University. We our dream and our desire was that he joins us at the Hebrew University. That was our wish. That happened ultimately. It happened very fast. And Chaim Sompolinski is at the university ever since, still very active.
Now, so if I understand well, so it was Sompolinski who brought, let's say, the method, the replica method.
Personally to us, yes. Yes.
So Daniel Amit was not already aware of the method, and he, because I think he was in contact already with Giorgio Parisi at the time.
Daniel Amit was in contact with Giorgio Parisi. There is this memorial book that Parisi is one of the editors, and he beautifully describes their previous interactions. So, but Daniel, before that, did not work on spin glasses. I certainly did not. I did other things. For us, it was a very rewarding learning period. And then the next thing that happened, and that is very a monumental breakthrough, and that was in 1987, when we came back from Santa Barbara. I already mentioned that we organized here a group at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Jerusalem. The many of the players were here either for the whole year or for short periods. Gerard Toulouse from Ecole Normale Supérieure was here for the whole year. At that time, by the way, there were two possible directions for the neural networks people to follow. And we here debated that at length, also with colleagues. One would be the direction of artificial intelligence, which means to use such artificial devices, systems of such neural networks to mimic systems of memory, of learning, of recognition, of generalization, of categorization. The other one would be to try to make better contact with biology. Ultimately, the group here, I don't know if it was a formal decision, but we were fortunate that one of the biologists was then at the school, at the medical school, did brain research, research on neural networks. His name was Moshe Abeles. He was one of the pioneers to recognize the importance of theoretical biology. Now, in those days, we had bitter debates, controversies with our colleagues at our university. They thought that it was a waste of time and money. They thought that the only way that biology, brain research, and research of biological, such biological networks could proceed was through the trial and error, through experiments that they were very suspicious of a kind of theoretical approaches to that. Moshe Abeles was maybe the only one who strongly believed that biology will make progress like other exact sciences by recourse to theoretical methods. In 1987, at that meeting, when Moshe Abeles was also present, there was a young star who spent most of the year with us. And that was a young woman. Her name was Elizabeth Gardner. I don't know if you know the name.
Yes, we know very well. I mean, we have been working in these years on...
So let me tell you about Elizabeth Gardner. Elizabeth Gardner came to École Normale Supérieure. She worked with Bernard Derrida. She published two seminal papers, one with him and one hers alone. And I should say something about her paper. Her paper was it was monumental in this field. It opened a whole new vista. And before I describe her work and how it relates, of course, applying strongly the replica method to her calculations. But Elizabeth was very modest, young lady, quiet. We did not know that she had cancer before she joined us. She never complained. She had always a smile on her face. We were shocked to hear about her death a few months after she came back from Jerusalem. She came home from Jerusalem. So that was Elizabeth Gardner. Now, let me tell you.
So you say that she spent several months in Jerusalem for this.
Yes. Yes.
So we know that she was already, had cancer. But you didn't know if she got any treatment.
We did not know that she had cancer. Maybe, I don't know if Bernard knew.
We already had a discussion with him and he said that he was not aware of the...
None of us. Nobody here was aware. By the way, Bernard also spent a few months with us here, that year. So you know what her main contribution was. You see, in the Hopfield model, the idea is the following, that there should be two dynamics here. One is the dynamic of learning, when you have such a network, and that in the dynamic of learning, you change the JIJs. You adapt the JIJs to have the desired attractors. Then there is the other dynamics, the fast dynamics, and this is the retrieval dynamics. In the Hopfield model, we sort of avoided the first step and we guessed the JIJs. Instead of a long process of learning, we replaced it by intelligent guesses. Of course, and in these guesses was all, the JIJs were all, of course, symmetrical because that is how we designed them, that's how we devised them. And it is all, and our solution of the Hopfield model was based on a particular guess of these JIJs. What Elizabeth Gardner showed us that one can, first of all, I mean, the basic, the deep idea is that one can separate the question. Suppose you have certain attractors and you want to learn, to find JIJs that will ensure that dynamics will lead you to that attractors. Yeah, suppose you want to find them. So you can find them by guessing, as we did in the Hopfield model, or by a certain learning procedure, which was known, and she showed that such a learning procedure for a kind of network, of a spinglass network, will converge in a final number of states, provided that a solution exists. That she could show, and she could make estimates on how long it will take and so on. But then she also showed that you can separate the question of finding those GIJs from the questions of such GIJs exist at all and how many there are. Because you see, the GIJs, the synaptic connections, they are continuous numbers, and there is a collection of n squared such numbers connecting every two neurons. And these, the solutions of the problem, and suppose you have certain prescribed attractors, and you know, you want to know what GIJs will give you the dynamics that will lead you to those attractors. So if the number of such attractors is not too big, and you have an infinite system of neurons, then there will be many such solutions. All the assembly of such solutions will form a volume. She showed that this is a concave volume. We form a volume of such solutions. And as you increase the number of the attractors that you want to embed in the system, that volume decreases until it decreases to zero and you have only one solution. And this gives you the capacity limit. And she found a way to calculate the volume of such solutions given under certain restrictions of the structure of the correlations between the embedded configurations, the desired attractor. And again, in calculating, since she wanted typical value, she had to calculate it. And she calculated not the volume, but the logarithm of the volume of all the possible of this hyperspace of all the possible JIJs interactions. And again, that required a replica symmetry method. And
so
very elegant, beautiful calculation, yes.
So can you tell us a bit more about your interactions with Elizabeth Gardner during that year and how it eventually led to a publication with her?
With that year, you see, the way we met daily discussing coffee ink, sandwiching together, everything. I mean, it is, she lived in Jerusalem. She gave seminars, we gave seminars. At the end, we I had a student there, his name was Idoye Kutieli. He did his master's degree with me. I was looking for a problem, I assigned him to a problem which we started to discuss with her. It is applying her method to networks where we imposed, you see, we could now impose certain restrictions on the JIJs. For example, there were models based on her method where the JIJs would not be continuous but integers. They would be limited in size. Now, we here, after this long period of struggling with the question of symmetry and asymmetry and what asymmetry does, we applied her model to the idea, to the question if when we impose a certain amount of asymmetry, if you have these JIJs, you can assign an asymmetry measure to them. Yeah, what is that essentially gives you a certain measure of the difference between the JIJ and JJI. And we could relate the storage capacity to the amount of asymmetry, to that asymmetry measure. We discussed this idea at length with her. Actually, she liked that we kept her busy. She died before this was completed. It was dedicated when it was published. It was published in this Journal of Physics A, a special issue dedicated to her memory. And of course, this was published there. By the way, the Journal of Physics A, I don't remember if I mentioned that, her paper was mentioned by the editors of Journal of Physics A, where she used to publish, the British journal, as one of the 50 most influential papers in the history of that journal.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Without surprise. So this event was extremely... Sorry, were you going to say something?
So
this event was extremely successful this year, and from what I understand, it led to the seeding of a institute or a center at the Hebrew U.
A little bit about that.
So can you tell us a bit about, or is there something else we should know about that year before moving on?
I mean, this was a very exciting year. I don't know, you know Peretto, the name of Peretto?
No, I don't.
He was a French scientist. He wrote a book, I forgot his first name, from Grenoble. He also spent a year from us. Gérard Toulouse suggested that we invite him. Annette Sipelius, I don't know if that name means anything to you.
Yes.
She spent time with us. Of course, John Hopfield visited briefly. Virasoro was here, Miguel Virasoro at that time. Now, following that, again, coming back, I know that if this interview would take place 5 years after that event, I would have much more to say because I remember this as a very exciting year. But my memory fails me now to recall many more details, except for the most basic elements which I already shared with you.
Maybe now, before we move on, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned several times the interactions with the Col Normal Superior, but I think you didn't give us any details. So how was it organized, the collaboration between your group and
the Col Normal Superior? Were very personal. You see, I spent several times mini sabbaticals at the Col Normal Superior. When this thing developed, immediately after we did our work here, I spent a few months at Orsay, and I gave a series of lectures on the recent developments of the, I even have notes of those lectures, the recent developments of these statistical physics of neural networks. And this was very well attended by students from the entire environment, from Saclay, from Ecole Normale Supérieure, from many places. I spent some time at Ecole Normale Supérieure. I even have a joint paper of one of these visits with Marc Mézard, a physics letter of those days, with Gérard Toulouse. We undertook a major initiative, and that is to edit a collection of seminal papers in those days from biology, computation, and physics. Again, all around this field, where we wrote words of introduction to every one of these papers. Biology and computation for physicists, and physics for biologists, and so on. So there were many, many things that happened in those days. They used to visit here after that seminar year several times. In France, there was also one biologist in France became interested in that development, and that was Jean-Pierre Changé. So he was also a part of a kind of a remote partner, but we talked. So many things happened in those years.
So
maybe the final chapter, it's not the final chapter, but the one that I was involved with, because my career ended maybe too soon, too early, when I was drawn into university administration, science, politics, when I became, first was elected as a rector of the Hebrew University, and shortly after that became its president. But in a way, that also played a role. And I'll tell you how. When we came back from these, from these international, there were, by the way, many international conferences also. Every big conference on statistical mechanics had a session. I remember giving an invited talk in Sao Paulo on the topic from neural statistical mechanics to neural networks and back. So there was a lot of interest, was a lot of activity. I mean, then we decided here that this would merit a special institute, a special program, a special PhD program that would bring together students from the different disciplines, from physics and biology and psycholinguistics and computer science and so on. And we submitted this proposal to the university. There was a very strong opposition to that idea, mainly from the biologists, as I mentioned to you. And it was based on the same arguments that this is a waste of time. I remember that in those days when we had one of those meetings, we invited Eric Kandel. And Eric Kandel visited us in Jerusalem. And so we presented what we were doing and how excited we were. We were very, you see, some of our biological colleagues thought that we were arrogant. The truth is that we were ignorant. And this is a combination of both.
This is kind of typical interdisciplinary interactions, right?
Yeah, but it was, so I remember Eric Kandel, I talked to him, and I don't know if any of you knows Yiddish, but his reaction was in Yiddish, thrown away money. But he changed since then. I know that he changed. There was this in Colombia with Abbott and his group, and the attempts of institutional organization at the Hebrew University, as I told you, was. What helped was that I was the rector of the university at that time, and I was convinced that so there is no, you cannot dictate, but you have ways to convince. And then we developed this research institute, ICNC, Interdisciplinary Research Center for Neural Computation. We witnessed the emergence of a new discipline. In addition to being part of it and observing it, we also discussed, and I, particularly in my administrative position, in my position at the top of the university, had to describe and define what it means to be part of an emerging, of a new emerging field. One of the most successful project of this ICNC Interdisciplinary Center for Neural Computation was its PhD student programs. We had about 25-30 members from the four different disciplines that I mentioned. We had PhD students. Every year we had a retreat for a few days with the students, all of them. They did very different things, but everybody knew what all the others were doing. The biologists knew what physicists were doing because they sort of closely interacted. We brought them to a retreat, a few days, a few nights. And one rule was that of those retreats, only the students lectured. And after years of existence of that, the Hebrew University brought in a peer review committee headed by a renowned medical scholar, Professor Feshbach. Several laureates, Nobel laureates were on that committee. The university received a very, very good report, certain recommendations, and now this center became a new center for brain research with a new building, magnificent building designed by the illustrious architect Norman Foster. If you come to Jerusalem,
you will definitely visit. Yeah, we have to visit it.
I rest my case. And long after I retired, I still continued to teach the basic course of the theory of neural networks, which now my younger colleagues have taken over. I look with great satisfaction and pride to what heights my younger colleagues are taking this initiative now. So that's it.
So by curiosity, during those classes, do you ever get to teach about replica symmetry breaking, or was this...
Not anymore.
Sorry?
What did you ask?
I ask if you ever taught replica symmetry breaking ideas and concepts.
Now let me tell you. Now this was a great pleasure. I taught the results and I explained the trick. But really to go through this calculation, that on every year when I got to that point, that was, I told them that every student who wanted to make an effort and have a guided tour, guided by me, in this replica symmetry calculations with first step replica symmetry breaking, line by line, I distributed those notes, and all those who volunteered, they met for a special meeting, not part of the course, but a corollary to the course, not part of the exams, but all those who came from physics and others, mathematics, they loved it. Actually, it was a great joy. It's a great joy to take curious, intelligent students through a certain tour de force sometimes, in other cases, surprising discoveries from step to step, and to take them through such a route from the beginning to the final result.
Wow. So we have one final question. This has been really an exciting tour, right? But the final question is, have you kept any papers, notes, correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have any plans to deposit them in an academic archive?
I drifted away from that field gradually, but then completely. I'm still officially a member of this ELSEC, of this center, but I from time to time go to seminars and lectures, trying to follow, not with a great success, but still, because I am very deeply involved in something else, completely. Written with another colleague, already 4 books on different aspects of the genesis of relativistic cosmology and how Einstein got to his equations of general relativity and so on. So I did not take the time even to organize my past. Your suggestion to engage in this made me think, and I will look at my notes and see what I can still salvage from there.
That would be really wonderful. Obviously, very few people have kept those notes. So if you have, it'd be a great addition to the historical and intellectual.
Tell me something about your initiative. How is it going?
So maybe we'll stop the recording. That's okay.
You have any other questions? You're happy with?
I think we've gone through everything. I mean, the only other question I didn't ask is if you had anything else to say, but I think we've covered every point that we had identified ahead of time.
Okay. That's it. So you can stop the recording.
Thank you.